This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last week, Russia negotiated a ceasefire between Armenia and Azerbaijan, ending a six-week war that left thousands dead. The dispute was over the Nagorno-Karabakh, a territory within Azerbaijan's border, but inhabited nearly exclusively by ethnic Armenians, many of whom are now forced to flee their homes, some reportedly burning them to the ground before they leave. To learn more about the conflict and what it means for the future of Armenia, I spoke with Anna Ohanian, a non-resident senior scholar for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Richard B. Finnegan Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Stonehill College. Also joining the discussion is Sergio Laporta, Haig and Isabel Berberian Professor of Armenian Studies and Interim Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at Fresno State.
Anna, I'm wondering if you could explain what has been taking place over the last couple of months. What led to this eruption from a geopolitical perspective, and then also from a perspective of the internal politics taking place both within Armenia and Azerbaijan?
Sure. The war has ended. The first war of Nagorno-Karabakh between Armenians and Azerbaijanis ended with a ceasefire in early 90s, negotiated by Russia at the time. So since then, this conflict sometimes would be described, often would be described as a frozen conflict because the level of hostility has gone down. The ceasefire largely was holding. There were no peacekeepers on the ground. So this was self-enforcing a ceasefire. There were skirmishes on the border. Average 25 per year, on average 25 soldiers would die, which in political science literature is usually described as a low intensity conflict. The dramatic shift started happening, and there was a peace agreement. There was a peace process that was developed to solve the very difficult issues of status of Nagorno-Karabakh. And the peace process negotiation format was under the OSCE Minsk group with France, United States, and Russia as members. And again, over the past, since early 90s, that Minsk group has been working. There have been several points at which the negotiators and Armenians and Azerbaijani leadership came close to a compromise, to finding a solution. But in 2016, there was the war erupted again, four-day war. After that, there was another war erupted this summer. In both cases, Azerbaijan essentially has been trying to recapture territory under Armenian control. The de facto territory of Nagorno-Karabakh in this period developed its institutions, carried out its elections, but it very much has been supported. Armenia has been the security guarantor for this tiny entity, not so tiny entity. Armenia also did control neighboring surrounding territories occupied, which essentially were described as they're under their Azerbaijani territory, but which Armenia was hoping, was planning to use as negotiation bargaining when the negotiation period would arrive. And over the years, Armenia position as Azerbaijan continued militarization, military buildup, very bellicose rhetoric, especially after President Aliyev came to power, inheriting his seat from his father. So this essentially started this insecurity cycle for Armenians, who then also hardened their position. What you saw over the past, over a month and a half, essentially, was a very different kind of escalation. This was not an escalation. This was a very different war because Azerbaijan brought in Turkey to support with all kinds of not only logistics but also drones, mercenaries that Turkey essentially deployed from Syria, where it is already involved in this conflict, as well as Libya. So Syrian mercenaries were dropped into South Caucasus, fighting on the side of Azerbaijanis, and it was really an asymmetric warfare. Very deadly, and considering that there was a negotiation process going on, this militarized approach stands out. As to why this particular, essentially, it was evolving and has been evolving, has been a proxy war if we considered the mercenaries and the Turkish support, and Russia, which has a security alliance with Armenia, not Nagorno-Karabakh, very much stayed on the sidelines, trying to broker a deal, negotiated a ceasefire a couple of times, which broke, did not hold. And perhaps we can talk about Russia later. But what is also important is that I do think that looking at this conflict for a while, that 2018 was significant development because Armenia has this Velvet Revolution. It was a democratic breakthrough, bottom-up, grassroots, nonviolent disobedience campaign, which strengthened, created a democratic dyad with neighboring Georgia. So this strengthened the democratic pole in South Caucasus. This put the pressure on Aliyev, which was a petrostate, unreformed petrostate, hereditary ruler pretty much. And studies show that this would have pressured Azerbaijani society also to democratize. But essentially, Azerbaijan responded very shrewd on the part of the Aliyev, President Aliyev. He pulled in Turkey, increasingly authoritarian state, and with all of the technology, military technology superiority, they really overwhelmed the Armenian forces. There's very little that Armenian side could have done.
Sergio, can you speak to the humanitarian crisis that has emerged as a result of this?
Sure. I would say there are two aspects to the humanitarian crisis. One is obviously the number of civilians who have been killed by the bombing, particularly by the drone attacks on the inhabitants of Karabakh. And now there are also the people who are going to be displaced due to the transfer of territories and the capture of Shushi, what the Azeris called Shusha. The future of these people is still uncertain. We don't know. I haven't been able to find accurate numbers. I haven't heard accurate numbers of how many people will have to move. We've seen dramatic videos of people burning their houses as they leave in tears, praying at the monastery of Dadivant before evacuating. But there will be there is an emerging humanitarian crisis as the question of where these people will go, whether they will go elsewhere within Nagorno-Karabakh or whether they will go to the Republic of Armenia. Neither place is particularly prepared to receive a large amount of refugees or to Russia as another possibility. So this is a crisis on the ground. I know it's a crisis that the diasporan community now is aware of and will be mobilizing itself to provide as much assistance as it can. But it will take one of the hard things about the conflict now is that in some ways the inhabitants of Nagorno-Karabakh were just recovering from the trauma that had been inflicted upon them during the last war in the 90s with the constant shelling from Shushi onto Stepanakert. The trauma was incredible. Many people had been out there to try and help the population with post-traumatic stress syndrome. They were just coming out of all of that. And now once again, they've been under attack and will have to evacuate their homes and be relocated.
And then can you also speak to the cultural monuments that could potentially be destroyed?
Yes. Now, there are a large amount of churches and monasteries in the area, both in what remains of Nagorno-Karabakh, as in to the territories that have been agreed upon to be ceded to control of Azerbaijan. Dadivank is one of the more famous ones. Again, a medieval monastery with a scriptorium. And in Shushi, there's St. Xavier Chazan Chetzot's church that has a lot of spiritual and emotional attachment to the population. We can also speak of other monasteries from the 5th century, such as Amaras. The eventual situation of these places is unknown. I mean, hopefully there are people, there are many petitions going around, and I know a lot of people have been encouraged to sign them to preserve the monumental cultural heritage of the area so that it's not destroyed. What is really making people nervous is that between 1996 and 2006, the Armenian Khachkars in the exclave of Nakhichevan which was under Azerbaijani control, were systematically destroyed, obliterated. And this was actually caught on video and by satellite. And the Azerbaijani government has denied it, even though it was there. And this has made people nervous that they'll do the same sort of cultural destruction in the areas that they have now captured in Karabakh. And so it's of the utmost importance that every international foundation and cultural heritage institution make sure that these areas are protected and not destroyed, and that restorers and conservators are allowed to go in to make sure that they will be allowed to stand and not even suffer from neglect. I know at the moment at Dadivank, there are Russian peacekeeping soldiers that are supposedly protecting the monks who have been allowed to stay there and to continue to worship. So maybe that will be a way forward, at least in the short term. But we will need some long-term protections for all of these sites in the areas that have been captured.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. You've just heard from Sergio Laporta, professor of Armenian Studies at Fresno State. We're also talking with Anna Ohanian, who is a professor of international relations at Stonehill College. Anna, where does Armenia go from here?
Well, the ceasefire agreement that was negotiated by Russia, which essentially the military victory of Azerbaijan was pretty overwhelming, and this essentially was forced on Armenia. There's very little Armenia could do. But in this agreement, the status, the most contentious issue, the status of Nagorno-Karabakh is not mentioned. So there's really, and it is important to note that since Nagorno-Karabakh received some stability with the end of the first Nagorno-Karabakh war, Nagorno-Karabakh population in Nagorno-Karabakh actually organized elections, built a parliament, so had worked to build these democratic institutions from the ground up. So the status of Nagorno-Karabakh is crucially, critically important moving forward. For Armenia itself, this protecting, essentially guaranteeing, supporting in the political status, trying to get a political status for Nagorno-Karabakh will remain on the agenda, absolutely. So at the same time, Armenia will now engage with Azerbaijan and Russia, hopefully by bringing in the French and the Americans as part of the OSCE Minsk group in order to start negotiating a more meaningful, more sustainable settlement, to arrive at a more sustainable settlement, which should include the status of Nagorno-Karabakh. Because of this vast ambiguities in the agreement, as well as the lack of clarity as to whether or not Europeans, OSCE Minsk group will come in, looks like they will be coming in, reintegrating, but it's unclear whether they will have the financial or the political capital in really building a peace process that will consider, reflect the interests of the Armenian community in Nagorno-Karabakh. That remains unclear, but hugely important for Armenia. Domestically for Armenia, now Nagorno-Karabakh will become, the question, the peace process will become a continuous factor that will make it very difficult for Armenia to consolidate its very fragile democracy that it now has succeeded to build in Russia's authoritarian orbit. So this is of huge concern. There are two essentially stories to follow. One is what will happen to Nagorno-Karabakh status, what type of peace process will be deployed, rebuilt in this process, whether Europeans will engage. And number two, what will the impact be of much stronger Russian presence in the South Caucasus and now Turkey's unrepentant genocidal power, Turkey wedged more firmly in Azerbaijan. These two powers, authoritarian powers, one providing for security, Russians did end the violence. It's very hugely important. It stopped the bleeding. But at the same time, Russians don't do peace building. They do provide security. So the question as to how the presence of these two factors will have on democratic consolidation in Armenia remains is a stressor, I should say. I am hopeful that because the way Armenia's Velvet Revolution emerged, it was bottom-up, non-violent, led by civic groups, studies show that these types of democratic breakthroughs are more likely to consolidate. So that definitely bodes well for Armenia. But there's a huge backlash against Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan, who led the revolution. There's backlash now against him for accepting these very painful concessions imposed on Armenia in this war. So that is something to watch. It is important to highlight that the political protest in Armenia against the Pashinyan government, some of which is led by the forces that were left out from that they could not get a seat in Armenia's democratic parliament. So these are, I refer to them as authoritarian reserves. Some of it is that, so it's not new. But the presence of this unresolved, essentially lack of clarity for Nagorno-Karabakh, the war, provides a very convenient sort of cover for all of these authoritarian forces to reemerge. So democratic institutions were watching to see whether they will hold, whether Armenia's new democracy, young democracy, can manage this crisis constitutionally through its institutions moving forward. And Armenia has demonstrated already once that it can produce a democratic breakthrough in Russia's authoritarian orbit. And it's an issue that now Belarus is struggling with, but Moldova, Kyrgyzstan, Ukraine, these are all countries that are learning to build democracy while living with Russia. So that is the challenge. I think Armenians have done it already since 2018. We just have to watch to make sure that these two issues, security, that Armenia does not have to choose between security provided by the Russians versus democracy, democratic consolidation that it has undertaken.
And I just want to say this because I think it'll be of interest to, you know, the people who are listening here in the Valley, since we do have such a large diaspora community, that one of the more notable aspects that we've seen of the conflict is the response that it has elicited, not just in Armenia, but also in the diaspora, and that there have been protests throughout, I would say, throughout the world and Armenian communities throughout the world, where the communities have become now engaged once again with what is going on in Armenia and with Artsakh. And if there is a positive aspect to this, which it's hard to call it that, but it has sort of awoken the Armenian diaspora again to realize that they can't just take the Republic of Armenia or Nagorno-Karabakh for granted. And they do have a role to play in the future of how this conflict unfolds. They need to be able to maintain pressure on various governments, not just Russia, but also the United States and France and in Europe, as well as to make sure that international organizations are involved and on the ground in protecting the Armenian sites that have now fallen under Azerbaijani control. So their voices have been heard. They're very active on social media, and they need to continue to be active in arguing for the rights of the Armenians in the region.
Anna Ohanya and Sergio Laporta, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.